Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Fly me to the moon. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood.
Man, there is a Comrex lag. How about that? Did you hear that? That's crazy. Anyway.
It's like a minute?
It is like a minute. I don't even know. That's like behind the scenes stuff that listeners won't care about. But we're going to have to explain in a future episode. Cannot tell you how excited I am for this episode of Make Me Smart, which is, because we got to say this, the producers make us. It's that thing where none of us is as smart as all of us. And we are made smarter today. I can't tell you how excited I am about this. By Sam Sanders from NPR. It's been a minute.
I know.
In the studio with me. I'm so excited, and Molly, you're not here.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's so
Fun fact, Kat, you've been on my show twice.
I know. Yeah. I know.
And you've been on my show twice remotely, so this is actually my first time being in the flesh.
I listen to you all the time, man.
Likewise. At some point before I leave, I'm going to have to record a video of you saying this is Marketplace. You know that's going to happen.
It's not a toy, Sam. We don't mess around with that.
Oh, okay.
I'm just kidding. All right. Anyway, so look, we are going to do a thing this week.
Wow. I'm going to back away from this love fest right now and try to get us back on the show.
So Molly, tell us what we're doing.
My God. Shameless. But I agree. This week, actually, I'm very excited about this. This was Kai's idea, and it's going to be a really good show. We are going to dig into the word and concept that no mainstream U.S. politician would have touched even a decade ago, even since the 2016 campaign. And now you are hearing it said out loud a lot. Socialism.
Yeah. Socialism.
It's everywhere.
It is
socialism.
Everywhere.
It is being both praised and vilified. It appears that it will be a defining conversation in the 2020 election campaign cycle, which I believe we started, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Some signs that this concept is on the upswing, though, in the market of ideas, those signs abound. Americans age 18 to 29 are as positive about socialism, 51%, as they are about capitalism, 45%. Mm. Which is remarkable. Senator Sanders, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, no relation, I think. I didn't want to steal your line, Sam, but no relation, is running for president in 2020. He identifies as a democratic socialist. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez uses that term for herself. She's taking on more leadership roles in the Democratic Party, and capitalism is on trial.
Right. Speaking of AOC, as she is known, although I hate that, actually, we should just use her whole name, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It came up in the show we did last week about the Green New Deal. The word socialism did. And you know, you can go to Merriam and look it up. It's about government ownership of the means of production and all of that stuff. But we want to talk today about whence it comes in this political debate we're having, how it's being weaponized to some degree in the political debate we're having, and what it really might mean for the 2020 election. And that's why Sam is here, because Sam covered Bernie Sanders in the 2016 campaign for NPR. You were embedded, right?
I was embedded with Bernie for several months.
So first of all, what was that like?
It was one of those things. So like when I was hired to do campaign coverage for NPR, I was second string. I wasn't an embed. I was going to do stuff from D.C. and possibly get out in the field every now and then. I got restless. I went to my bosses and I said, I want to be on the road too.
Good for you.
And they said, well, how about you go to one or two Bernie Sanders rallies? He's not going to go anywhere. He took off. And before I knew it, I was like a Bernie embed and I was on the trail for a very long time. And, you know, I can't overstate enough. All of our national conversation right now about socialism, it is centered around and has been started by Bernie Sanders. He has been a Democratic socialist for years, for decades, and his run for the Dem nomination in 2015 and 16 really put socialism on the map. It all, in this current iteration, goes back to him.
It is pretty remarkable, and it's funny because Last week, I was saying, oh, I was just listening to some great podcast where they were talking about the Overton window and the idea that conversation moves in a certain direction.
That was us.
What was that? And then, that thank God, Twitter reminded me that it was, no, I heard it on Sam's show.
Yeah, it's a great
term. That's the show where they were talking about the Overton window.
Yeah.
And Bernie Sanders is, you know, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now, but certainly Bernie Sanders, I think, has to be credited with moving the Overton window to the point where a conversation that includes the word socialism, not only is it not a deal breaker or a third rail, but you really truly have kids saying right now,
I like that.
No, this seems way better than what we got going.
Yeah. And so Overton window, this idea that there are certain things that are part of reasonable debate in the public square and how people or politicians can shift that left or right. Bernie shifted the Overton window over the last few years towards socialism. And when we even think about other folks that are using that word now, like AOC, she came from the Bernie camp. She worked on his campaign. Like, it all stems from him, right? And I think if you want to conceptualize the biggest way in which he made socialism cool again, was really pushing hard on the stump last time and even harder now for Medicare for All.
Right.
And this was a thing that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, said, well, we can't do. But now you have lots of candidates in 2020 saying, sure, why not?
They're climbing on the bandwagon. Kamala and Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren and, you know, Sherrod Brown, when he gets in, almost certainly will, assuming he gets in, which he almost certainly will.
Yeah.
But look, so that's two politicians out of 11 gajillion who are openly Democratic Socialists, right?
Yes.
We should talk about what Democratic Socialist means.
But,
but also you have the president of the United States standing in the well of the House in the State of the Union saying, we will never be a socialist nation. And so it has now, as it inevitably was going to be, has become weaponized.
And the reason it's weaponized is because socialism is a word that can mean a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. If you go to the website for the Democratic Socialists of America, this is a party that Bernie belongs to and is affiliated with, as well as AOC. Mm-hmm. They even say on their website, there are different strains of this. Some DSA members believe that all of the businesses and corporations and every business interest should be controlled by the state or by the workers. Others believe less so. So Bernie, if you look into his version of socialism, he believes that capitalism can still exist, that corporations can be there, but they need more control. And he thinks that certain parts of our government should be totally run by the government, like healthcare.
How close is this to, in some ways, what Democrats used to think?
Yeah, there's been a blurry line between progressive Democrats and socialists ever since the New Deal. And depending on the time and the tenor of the debate, people use various labels. But I think when we think about Bernie and AOC and democratic socialism, what they're basically arguing for is more government interventions in certain parts of our economy led by the government, like healthcare. This is entirely different than what Donald Trump means when he says socialist in a speech. He is referring to the most extreme version of socialism where the government runs everything. There's no more private industry. And no one right now tied to Bernie or to AOC or the Democratic candidates is saying that. But Donald Trump knows that a lot of his voter base, you know, older white Republicans, they hear socialism, they think communist, they think Cold War, they think whatever.
So what about that slice of the Democratic Party, which does not yet include anybody running, I think, whose gut says, yeah, you know, maybe I'm with you, Bernie, on some of this and Alexandria, but let's back off and let's not put it in people's faces yet.
Oh, yeah. This is the constant struggle.
Biden.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. This is a constant struggle with progressives and Democrats and the left that I've been seeing since I covered the last election. Right. There are all of these things that the left and Democrats want to do. There are questions about how quickly to do it. Do you gradually expand healthcare until you reach Medicare for All? Do you do it drastically right now in one fell swoop? That's the debate. And I think that we don't know how it's going to shake out. I do know that the conversation we're hearing now about healthcare on the left right now, it will for sure not be this far left come next year.
Yeah.
As soon as there's a nominee selected that is that's trying to peel off Trump voters, it's going to be a very different conversation. So the socialist gospel you're hearing right now, it'll be different next year.
Sure. But What I do think is interesting is I was listening to a different podcast that was not yours. I can remember which one. But they were talking about how the Republican Party now feels very energized by having socialism as an enemy going into this campaign. And that, you know, in the lead up to 2020, Republicans are excited to be able to run on this sort of wholeheartedly capitalist platform.
Oh, yeah.
At a time when only 45% of young Americans view capitalism positively, at a time when I think, you know, we feel it is now incontrovertible to say that trickle down does not trickle down. How do you feel when you hear that approach, when you hear like the Republicans are going to double down on capitalism?
Oh, it's smart. I think like the thing that the Republican Party is very good at is a kind of messaging that makes a very stark distinction between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And Democrats, especially in these policy debates, want to get very nebulous and cerebral and parse the details. The one thing that Donald Trump is really good at is saying, this is this, that is that, I am here, they are there, this is good, that is bad. And when you have a debate about socialism versus capitalism, he might win that one because lots of voters like to see the world in very stark terms. But I also think it's really important to just like step back from all of this and say that like no one government is just one thing. You know, we think of America as like this democracy. We are, in fact, a representative democracy.
Oh, that is my favorite part.
You know, like we vote for the folks that vote for us. And there are certain portions of the government that might feel a little more socialist-y than other parts. Like when you think of the way that we do food, like regulation, that is entirely socialist. The government regulates that. They inspect the food. But when you think of other parts of our government, like say the EPA right now, it is an agency that is kind of controlled by the industry it's meant to regulate, and you could call that a corporatocracy, right? Like there are different parts of our government that feel different ways. And so if we really want to talk about socialism, the real conversation is what parts of our government do we want to be more socialist? Mm-hmm. Not do we want to be socialist or not? It's not that simple.
But that's not a conversation we are able to have in this country, right? I mean, come on.
Not in a general election for president.
I want to touch on something you you sent us a note with some of your thoughts and things that you think are important. And I want to touch on this idea that you brought up of socialism and race in this country.
Yeah.
And how that plays out.
Yeah. I mean, so like I've been thinking a lot about Bernie and my time covering him and challenges he will face as he goes into this race. And one of the lingering critiques about Bernie, well, there were two big ones. This idea that he was really concerned with the economy and nothing else. And also that he really had a big blind spot when it comes to race. You know, he was famously interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters in Seattle when he was running. And after that, he hired a black press secretary, Simone Sanders, who came from an activist justice background to try to respond to that. Yeah. But even by the end of the campaign, he was still dogged by these critiques that he doesn't think about race enough. And I talked to folks on the trail who were close to him and said, yeah, that's kind of true. And so what I find really interesting now is that in 2020, the whole conversation on the left and with these candidates is going to be more focused on race than it has ever been before for a number of reasons. A lot of Democrats see Donald Trump is explicitly racist and that they have to counter that. There is a more diverse crop of candidates than ever before. I'm talking about Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about Castro. I'm talking about Cory Booker, et cetera. And also, some of the issues that are trickling to the forefront of these Democratic conversations are inherently tied to the economy and race. Talking about reparations.
Yeah.
I never would have thought that would be a conversation topic with Democrats, but it is.
Do you think that conversation about reparations and race in this economy, right? When you talk about race and socialism, you're talking to a large degree about race in this economy. Is that going to get dragged back to this more to the center, you think, as a general election approaches, right? And we've got an actual nominee.
If I were a betting man, I would bet that you're not going to hear whoever the nominee is for the Democratic Party say the word reparations. But we're having that conversation right now. And I think what's going to be really interesting, especially with issues like reparations right now, is to see how Bernie Sanders tackles that issue, which is inherently tied to race and the economy. Yeah. The way this conversation is going on right now, there are lots of Democrats saying we would do reparations through things like tax credits. So this is an issue that is inextricably tied to race and the economy. Mm-hmm. And I think the lingering critique that people have against Bernie is that you cannot talk about economic policy in America or social policy in America without acknowledging how race affects it. And there are examples throughout history that show this to be true.
Yeah.
Well, it feels like one of the lasting successes, even if we get to the general election and these conversations are not explicit, it does feel like one of the lasting successes could be, and you see this with the Green New Deal too, tying race and economics together so inextricably that it's that it really is indisputable. That you stop having, you know, you stop talking about race as, I don't know, as culture or any other thing. You start saying, like, look, if everybody is not participating equally in this economy, if everybody is not being prosecuted equally, policed equally, then our economy won't succeed. And it feels like that is something that that Democrats are trying hard now to tie together.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, we should always be having that conversation because throughout our history, all of our government has been tied to race and been governed by race, and law has been written based on race. Race is written into our Constitution, right? And there yes, are several recent examples in which the expansion of federal government programs, it was implemented in a racist way. I mean, if you go back to the New Deal, the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, it was really great for factory workers, but written out of that bill were maids and ag workers, and that was meant to leave black people out. Mm-hmm. When you think about the GI Bill, which sent veterans to college, that was administered not by the federal government, but by local governments who could leave out blacks in the South if they wanted to. Also, what good is a GI Bill to a black veteran if no college will accept him, right? You know, even policy debates right now that we're trying to take away from race conversations, they're tied to race. Weed being legal right now, and everyone can jump into the marijuana economy. Actually, you can't if you have a record. And some of the folks that are most likely to have a record for marijuana convictions are black and brown people.
And let's be honest, you can't actually, even if you don't have a record, it's going to be tougher for you as a black or brown person to get into the marijuana business just because.
Yes.
Right? It just will.
Exactly.
So look, And I hate to mix my podcasts here, but we had Wesley Morris on a couple of weeks ago talking about the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
And we had a long conversation about Green Book.
I bet you did.
Right? So you know where I'm going. We're having all these conversations, the three of us, about this. And yet 2 days ago, or whatever the heck it was, Green Book wins the Academy Award for Best Picture with all of the baggage that it brings. And so we're still trapped in this cycle.
Yes.
It's yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk about the Academy Awards, I think that conversation misses some of the structural realities of race and the Academy, because when you think about who wins the Oscars, it is the films that have the biggest lobbying campaign and push to win. And those are usually white movies from white studios because the resources go there.
Yep.
So like you think about a film like Roma, which is a foreign language film, but made by someone who is white. They spent more money promoting the film than actually making the film.
That's because Netflix has so much money.
Exactly.
Anyway, yeah.
Or like films like Sorry to Bother You, which folks thought should have been up for some Oscars. Yep. It got no Oscar nominations, in part because they chose not to campaign, not to lobby, not to spend that money. And so like race and the economy and the economics of race and who gets what infuses everything from the Academy Awards to socialists.
To everything.
The Green New
Deal.
Run
for office to the Green New Deal to the Green Book. Race
is in it. Nicely done! Oh my God! Oh, that was amazing!
Bravo!
I think
Bravo,
that's,
Sam.
I think the microphone has been dropped. Right? Are we done? Molly Wood, what else you want to know?
Mm-hmm.
You good?
Yeah. Why would we keep going after that?
Did I say corporatocracy right? I think I might have.
I don't know. But you came up with Green Book and Green New Deal, and we're done. Sam Sanders from NPR. It's been a minute. It is so nice to have you in the studio and to finally meet you face to face.
Likewise. Come back on my show. I like to have you on every few months
to
remind me that the stock market is not the economy.
There we go. Thanks, Sam.
I also love Sam Sanders. I will tease you forever about fanboying that hard.
Well, come on. He's awesome.
I think we're in agreement. We want to know what you think. What do you think? What do you think about this idea that socialism and capitalism and are the Democrats going to fall into a trap of trying to like explain the difference between this kind of socialism and that kind of socialism?
Spoiler alert. Yes, they will. They will. They will.
Oh, no. Yeah. If Democrats can fall into a trap of overthinking things,
of anything,
they will get in their car and drive to that trap.
Yeah.
Send us a voice memo with your thoughts at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We're going to take a little break and then we'll be back with our fixations.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're back. We are back. Sam has left. Sam, come back, Sam.
We are bereft.
We are bereft. We are Samless. there is only really one thing that I'm going to mention, a little shameless self-promotion, which I don't do a lot of, but I will this time. And then, Molly, you can do whatever you want to do. How about that? Because once again, okay. Oh, by the way, you'll put nothing in the rundown. Once again.
I know. I don't know who I am anymore. Well, Loser. You'll understand when I get to my Loser. Fixation.
Okay. Oh, you have one. You're just not telling me what it is? What are you, taking a page out of my book? All right. Anyway.
It's here.
No, don't do that. I don't want to see it. All right. So look, I'm going to play I think it's like a 3-second piece of tape, but it has gone very well for Marketplace, shall we say. Here it is.
Do you think the president has a grasp of macroeconomic policy?
No, I do not.
So that was Janet Yellen, late of the Federal Reserve, in her office last Thursday in Washington, D.C. with me. She has the office next door to Ben Bernanke, by the way, for whatever that's worth. Although, you know what's really interesting? She's got this teeny tiny little office, and he's got the giant big corner suite, which is really interesting.
Wait, what?
Now,
really?
Yeah. But look, here's the deal. He clearly lives and works in his office. You know what
home,
I mean?
Though.
Yeah, and she does a lot of work at home. So that explains that. But anyway, we had Dr. Yellen and I. I've spoken with her a bunch of times off the record, and we finally convinced her that it was time for me to put a microphone in her face. We had a really good chat. We went half an hour. We played about 10 minutes on Marketplace yesterday, Monday, of which that item, does the president understand macroeconomic economic policy? No, he doesn't, was the news. What was really interesting, though, was the follow-on. Because what happened was I asked her that question. I did not actually expect that she would say what she was actually thinking. And I knew she was thinking that because she and I have spoken many times in the past. But she did. And you can hear me on tape kind of go, tell me more. And she did. And she really laid it out. He doesn't understand trade and tariffs. He doesn't understand balance of payments or trade deficits. He doesn't understand a bunch of stuff. And I thought it was A, fascinating, and B, really interesting that now she has decided enough is enough and she's going to say that stuff out loud. And that's sort of been on my mind the last couple of days.
Well, and let's not gloss over the fact that literally then the next day, Senator Sherrod Brown was asking Fed Chair Jay Powell, do you agree with Janet Yellen's assessment as told to Kai Ryssdal? That was a remarkable interview on many levels, but the main thing that struck me about her answer was not just that she answered it, but that answer came so fast.
Well,
there wasn't even a breath. She was like, nope.
So it's really interesting. So the first time I listened to, all right, a little sausage making here. I usually don't listen back to my interviews until they're ready to go on the air because I really can't stand hearing myself on the radio. But I did not hear that one until it played, and I trusted my producers to make the cut. And in my memory, the way it went was I said, do you think the president has a grasp of macroeconomic policy? There was a beat, and then she said, no, I don't. And in reality, what happened was before I was done asking the question, before the word policy was out of my mouth, she said, no, I don't. It was really interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And telling.
It was like she was just dying to say it. Yeah. It was that, I think, was almost the most telling part is the I know it's not nonverbal, but whatever, you know, just how fast that answer came
the
was
verbal,
just
nonverbal.
It's literally the opposite of nonverbal. I don't know what I'm going for here. Yeah. But it was remarkable. Yeah. Mine is sort of related to this, I guess, in a weird way, because it is ultimately economic. But the only thing that I'm fixated on right now, which is why I didn't even put anything in the rundown, because I'm just a hot mess, is the Oakland school strike.
Yep.
Because I live in Oakland and my kid goes to public school and is upstairs playing Fortnite again, even as we speak.
Oh, man. Really?
Ugh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I put a note on Nextdoor that was just like, what are people doing? Because, you know, we've sort of gone through all the faux curriculum stuff we can do here.
Yep.
And then also, I just can't, I'm working. I can't pay attention to him every minute and make sure that he's doing some homework or coding instead of,
How long has he been out of school? How many days?
Today is the fourth day. Today, Tuesday, as we're recording this, is the fourth day. We took this morning at 7:30 food to the picket line at his public middle school because the teachers actually need food to take home, not just like snacks, but like canned goods. and non-perishables for both students and teachers, because the teachers make so little that if they're on strike for more than a few days, that, you know, my sister-in-law is a public school teacher who already is saying, look, I've done the math. If this goes 4 or 5 more days, I actually have to cross the picket line because we won't be able to pay rent. But, and so it's obviously like now it's hitting me really hard, right? But this is not, it is not just a California thing. I was tweeting about it this morning and people are like, it's Prop 13. I mean, sure, there are California-specific budgeting things that are contributing to the Oakland strike and the LA strike. You guys just had one.
Yep.
But teachers all over this country have been striking. And the best thing that somebody sent me, and I will have it in our on our website, I hope, was a report from the Economic Policy Institute about how that what they call the pay penalty. It's like you literally get penalized for becoming a teacher because you make so little.
Yeah.
The wage and compensation gaps started in the 90s. That teacher salaries essentially started going backwards in the 1990s. And that now the penalty that you pay for becoming a teacher is arguably just absurd. It's absurd.
I don't think it's arguable. I mean, it's ridiculous. We don't pay our teachers more. There's no argument there, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes. Anyway, right. This was a really good piece. We'll have it on the website. Several people suggested that a story on the economics of, or an episode on the economics of education might be in the making. And I'd love to hear what you guys think about it. And then also, if you have ideas for what you're supposed to do when your kid is home on strike, like, send them to me if you got homework.
Yeah.
Because also, this is just crazy. Also, I live here. I mean, living here in the Bay Area, one of the wealthiest areas of an already richest country in the world, and seeing us not be able to figure this out is really difficult.
All right.
And that's that.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Michael, right? Isn't that this guy's name? Michael something?
I think so, yeah.
Matthew.
Oh, it's so Matthew. Anyway,
Matthew. Yes.
Our favorite. Okay, you guys definitely, just like us, got a kick out of last week's Make Me Smart question. A thing that I learned, by the way, after that was that the reason, because, you know, we had that conversation about how Weezer remade. The answer, by the way, was our listener, Wade Young, learning the correct lyrics to the Toto song Africa after years of singing the wrong ones. Right. And I was like, oh, that song's totally a thing now because Weezer remade it. And then in looking up the Weezer song to send you guys, I discovered that the only reason that Weezer did a remake of that song was because of a Twitter campaign by like a 14-year-old girl.
Is that right?
Yes. Oh my God. I had no idea that that's why that song is a total thing now. And then just a few days later, I took my son to Panic at the Disco for an early birthday present and they warmed up. They like played Weezer's Africa
Best
remake to warm up the crowd. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah, I was totally old mom at the concert. Anyway, the correct lyrics are, let's get back to it. The correct lyrics are, Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus over the Serengeti.
Yes.
Olympus, not, as he originally thought, a leprous. Even though I like that better, kind of.
Kind of.
So anyway, listener Gil Cabrera from San Diego sent us this voice memo with the official term for that thing when you mishear the lyrics and you think that that's what they say forever.
Molly's comment about what she thought song lyrics were reminded me that there's actually a term for that. It's Mondegreen is, I believe, the way it's pronounced. And it was coined back in the 50s, actually, tied to both songs and poems, where the listener mishears it and replaces words for things that make sense. So I think we've all done it. It made me laugh, and I wanted to let you know there's actually a term for that.
That's a
Love the show.
I'm looking it up right now. And there you go. Mondegreen.
That's amazing. And also, shout out to Gil Cabrera, who has been a part of my podcast world since like 2005. Hi,
no
Gil.
Joke. Wow.
See you on the internet, buddy.
54. Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, there you go. Learn something new every day.
Mondegreen. I know. That's really good. No that joke. Was a really good one.
Sandra Weber from Kirkland, Washington, left us this voice memo saying, well, I'm gonna let you say what she thinks. Here you go. Listen to her.
Hey, I was listening to your Green New Deal episode, great episode, by the way, and your guest said something that made me a little worried. She said that younger generations seem to be more concerned about climate change, with the inference that you know, if we leave it in their hands, everything will trend in the right direction. I'm not so sure that's true. And in fact, there's a George Mason University study that says, really, if you look at the entire generation and not just the ones out, you know, rallying, their views fall more in line with us older generations.
I am going to require the playing of the Dark Place sting now, because I had nothing to do with that. And what this lady just said was humanity sucks. Right?
Oh,
right?
She did.
Well, she did too. She did too. And Sandra, I apologize, but that's kind of what it is. Because if you can't have faith in the younger generation.
She didn't say they sucks.
That's what she meant. Read between the lines.
I mean, I think she said that it makes perfect sense that the younger generation, having grown up with the viewpoints of their parents, would broadly fall more toward the center.
And as we know, parents of all ages, well, I'm not going to say that bad word again, right? But you know what I mean, right?
Bummer.
Come on. Sandra, I'm sorry, but that's kind of the way it rang to me. That's all I'm saying.
We have a link to the study that she cited in the show notes at makemesmart.org that says that millennials are not any more engaged on climate change than anyone else. Fine.
Yes, fine. There we go. Just saying.
All right. Let's pick this up. Let's pick it up, shall we? Hopefully with a happy something or other. The Make Me Smart question, or, you know, the answer more accurately. The question is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? This week, Aisha Tyler, actor, writer, comedian, and director. You might remember her from the show Archer, her former podcast Girl on Guy, or The Talk, or Talk Soup, if you go way back. I love her. She had this song called No ASS at All that was hysterical. Anyway.
You can
spelling
spell it,
is
you
way
can't
better,
say
right?
It, right? Because that 9-year-old in the backseat of the car certainly can't spell. But okay,
I can't spell that. It's only 3 letters.
Oh my god!
Anyway, look it up. It's super funny. Anyway, her answer is related to directing her first film, which is called Axis.
So I think the thing that I thought I knew when I started out in the entertainment business was that I had to follow the rules, and that I needed to know the right people, and I had to have access to the right rooms. But what I find and what I continue to discover is that you can make your own rules. You may have to work a little harder, which typically underrepresented communities have to do anyway, but that you can forge your own path if you are willing to work twice as hard as everybody else. There were a lot of points of realization, but one that was pretty galvanizing was when I wanted to make my first feature film, and I knew that it was going to be very hard to put together traditionally, and that a lot of people were telling me that I needed to change it, and I needed to rewrite it, and I needed to change the actors, and I was never going to get this movie funded in this way. And then I just crowdfunded it, and I made it on my own terms. But then that film ended up being a unique creative calling card for me as a director. And if I had done it the traditional way, I wouldn't have been able to make the iconoclastic, specific personal film that I made. And that movie has opened the doors to lots of other filmmaking opportunities.
Yeah, so don't follow the rules, right? If you want something bad enough, you're going to find a way to do it, right?
You're going to have to hustle.
Yeah. Which
you're
is awesome advice.
Hustle.
I mean, that's great. And it's, you know, it's truer now than ever, actually, I think.
I think it really is, yeah. And people, I mean, you know, it can be crippling to feel like, oh, you have to do all of it yourself and no help is coming, but it is also very freeing. The film she made, Axis, is about an actor struggling with addiction. It came out in at Sundance last January in 2018. Aisha Tyler. I'm gonna tweet that link to that video.
Yeah.
About not having a bottom.
The Make Me Smart question is, of course, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? The voice memo can be addressed to makemesmart@marketplace.org. And we will get it on the pod. There we go.
I'm waiting.
I know.
Make Me Smart is produced. There it is. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris and senior producer Eve Turow, or as I like to call them, Thelma and Louise.
Oh,
Tony
nice.
Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, neither of whom actually listen all the way to the end of this podcast. I'm going to keep saying that until I hear about it.
Again?
I'm going to keep saying that until I hear about it. I have yet to hear about it. It's my little protest.
Actually, that's really true.
All right. I mean,
that's really true.
You don't like it, prove me wrong. That's all I'm
saying.
Does
anybody listen until the end of the podcast, though, ever?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.